The Broadway Hour. This is Stuart Klein. Stay tuned for an hour of live music and very live conversation all about the theater. With us tonight, comedian Mort Saul, actress Dorothy Loudon, and singer Annie Ross, brought to you by Sheraton New York Hotel and Towers. And let's kick off the Broadway Hour up-tempo with the singer now starring at Rainbow and Stars. She's an alumnus of the great jazz vocal trio Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, and accompanied by Mike LaDon at the piano. Ladies and gentlemen, live on the Broadway Hour, here's Annie Ross.
Someday, when I'm awfully low and the world is cold, I will get a glow just thinking of you, just the way you look tonight. But you're lovely, with your cheeks so soft and your smile so warm. There is nothing for me but to love you just the way you look tonight. With each smile, your tenderness grows, tearing my fears apart. And that laugh that wrinkles your nose touches my foolish heart. Lovely, never, never change. Keep that breathless charm. Won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you just the way you look. Your tenderness grows, tearing my fears apart. And that laugh, that silly little laugh that wrinkles your nose, touches my foolish heart. Lovely, 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 never, never, never change. Keep that breathless charm, won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you just the way you look tonight. Tonight.
Yeah, Annie Ross. Annie, just as you began, the ice machine at the Posh Bar at the Lobby Court Lounge went into action. Just take you back to any of your early days on the road?
It takes me back to a lot of my early days on the road, and it's still happening, let me tell you.
Annie, welcome back to New York.
Thank you.
When's the first time you played the Big Apple?
The first time, I think it was Birdland.
Uh-huh.
With John and Dave.
That's going back to what, the 40s, 50s?
I would say the early 50s.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I can hear that.
There it goes.
Yeah, yeah.
We are in the lobby of the Sheraton New York Hotel and Towers, adjacent to the ice machine at the bar. Annie, I think a lot of our listeners would be surprised to learn, talking about the early days, that you started your screen career as a child star in the Our Gang comedies, no?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about it. How did that happen?
I don't really know how it happened. I don't know who saw me or who arranged it or whatever. But I remember being on the set. I remember doing my one number, a jazz version of Loch Lomond. I remember Spanky McFarlane gave me a charm bracelet. I remember meeting Darla Hood, you know. And I had a ball. It was great.
You have no horror stories about being a child performer?
No, not really. I was always ready to perform. I was always precocious.
How'd you become a jazz singer, Eddie?
Well, my aunt was a singer, and her name was Ella Logan.
Ah.
And she, when she came into town to California, where I was brought up, She always had parties. At these parties were people like Duke Ellington, Roy Eldridge, Earl Garner, Lena Horne. So I was into that kind of modern music from the very off. I mean, when I was six, the best thing she did was to give me a record of Ella Fitzgerald singing A Tisket a Tasket, which I learned upside down and backwards. And that set me on the path to modern jazz.
And how did you link up with Hendrix and Lambert?
Well, I happened to be at a friend's house, Gene and Bob Bach, down in the village, and Bob said, there are two guys coming over that are going to demonstrate what they would like to do on record, which would be putting words to Count Basie instrumentals. And would you want to stick around? And I said, sure. So I did, and in came John, in came Dave, and they played this album, and they sang along with it, and I thought, well, that's good. And I had just written words for a thing called Twisted, so I was very familiar with that style. And I thought, well, why didn't they ask me? Oh, well. And I went back home, and I got a phone call from either Dave or John saying, we've hired six session singers, six males, six females, to try to recreate the sound of Basie. We're having problems with the women and the guys. I'm going to coach the guys, said Dave. Why don't you coach the women? I said, what do you want me to coach? He said, I want you to coach them like to get the Basie feel. And I said, sure, I'll do that. So I put the phone down and I thought, this is going to be ridiculous. I mean, how do you teach six people something that's taken you a lifetime to learn? So anyway, I went down and I did the best I could, but it just didn't happen. And then John, or Dave rather, said, wait a minute, I got an idea. We have all this time left. We have no product. We need to do something. So why don't we multi-track? I had no idea what he was talking about, but I said, sure. So we went off and we learned the harmonies. I had to learn the harmonies. And then we did the first track. Then the second track, we recorded that. And I knew when I heard it coming back through those speakers that it was something totally innovative, totally new, totally exciting. And it was a moment of magic. And I got back home with a demo tape. And I rang Miles Davis and I said, Miles, listen to this. And we were about eight bars in. And he said, wait a minute. Mingus, pick up the phone. So Charlie Mingus picked up the phone on the extension. And that was it. I mean, every musician loved it.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yep.
Annie will be back to talk with you more later in the program. Right now, we got to go to a break. And after the break, coming up, Mort Saul. Speaking of laughter rights now, let's introduce our next guest. He's been a comic gadfly in the ear of the establishment since the Eisenhower years in the 50s. And like that toy rabbit, he's still going. His new stand-up show, Mort Saul's America, opens tonight at Theater 4 in West 55th Street. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Mort Saul.
Thanks, Stuart.
Mort,
thanks,
it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Broadway Hour.
Well, you got an illustrious group here today. You know, I was going to, just an addendum to what Annie was doing. You know, I was here with Stan Kenton, working with Stan Kenton at Basin Street East for Ralph Watkins, and I remember getting Sing a Song of Basie, but you know, what's really great about that, it operates on about four levels. I mean, it's a musical level, there's also a literary level, and there's a satirical level of all the material. It's ultra hip. It operates like Chaplin. It's on about four levels. All art does, by the way.
Speaking of satire.
Yes. What do you have in mind?
How rich...
yes.
How rich is the field for political satirists today?
Well, of course, it's wide open, but you know, the comedians are pretty indifferent politically. Mm-hmm. It helps if you come from radical parents.
You want to give
people us... don't like their parents. You know about that. I tried to be in the Donahue show, you know, to help them publicize the theater opening. And one of the requirements is you have to be molested by your parents. And Phil Donahue's staff found out that I like my parents, which makes me an outcast in New York. So I finally compromised with them. I'm doing the show Tuesday, and I was molested, but by Roseanne Arnold's parents. They've been indicted anyway, so it doesn't matter.
So you gave him a good childhood, Bart.
Well, yeah. I went to the movies, and I believe in a search for romance and justice, which puts tremendous responsibility on women who were invented by lonely writers in hotel rooms.
What do you think about the women's movement?
Well, the idea of a woman being an executive and having economic power and being able to have all the privileges they've seen men have, which is to sleep with people half their age and not call them the next day, means that the new women are just like the old men. Why do you want to, to all women I address this, why do you want to be like us? What a dubious ambition. You can be a first-class girl. Why do you want to be a second-class guy? You know, it's important.
It seems that there are fewer women getting married quickly today. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, somebody suggested that nobody wants to get married anymore except an occasional Catholic priest. Homosexuals are monogamous, you know.
Homosexuals are right, I'm sorry.
They're monogamous. They preempted the field, you know. But, look at the Democratic Party in Los Angeles, you know. Paul Newman and Redford, who were the finance chairman out there for Dukakis and Gary Hart, they found out that Gary Hart had a girl, you know. And I was about to vote for him. And they said, you can't vote for him. He's got a girl. And I wiped my brow. I said, well, thank God I found out in time. You know, I wouldn't want a guy like that leading our party. What kind of madness is it, you know? They've led us away from everything we should aspire to. I don't know if you can ever realize love, but you should aspire to it.
What else are you going to do? To aspire to?
Yeah, love and justice.
As a matter of fact, Bette Midler, in her recent stand-up show at the Music Hall, she was talking about Long Island. And she said, it takes so long to get to Long Island and so long to get back that once you get there, you only have two desires, to either make love or kill. She said the only other option was to shop for discount appliances.
I read in Parade magazine Sunday that she's become a show business legend at only 46, which means when I worked with her, Mr. Kelly, she was only 10, and boy, she was good. She was really good. You know, she could sing. And I remember going to a museum here some years ago, and they had a big lithograph outside on Madison Avenue. It said, Liechtenstein, 1960 to 1970. I think a guy that gifted would die at 10. You know, it's terrible. Well, okay.
Any other subjects of note you find ready to be commented on, Bort?
Well, I was going to talk about politics, you know, with the fact that God bless President Clinton, long may he waver. But every time I see Annie, I start thinking of all my days in the jazz business, you know, because in the beginning, nobody knew what I was talking about, and the musicians kind of gave me a tolerant place to work where I could, you know, find myself and not lose all my confidence, because they would always laugh. And I remember that musician's humor always appealed to me because it detected sham immediately.
Right.
You know, I remember walking up Broadway after a job with Stan Kenton, and he was having trouble with his first trumpet player, and he said to me, I can't understand how a guy can be so gifted and have such a terrible personality. And then he said to me, one day he said, I think I know how it happens. He says, God parts the clouds, and he points to a farm, and he says, I think I'll make that guy, farmer's son, the best trumpet player in America. I said, yes, and Stan said, and then God stopped. So that was kind of, you know, that's the stuff I grew up with, you know.
Mort, there's a breaking political story of note here in New York.
Yes.
We have a new candidate for governor.
Yes.
Howard Stern.
Is Albany far enough? I was down, speaking of the government, I was down at WNYC the other day, and Rudolph Giuliani was going from room to room with his flamethrower, and he introduced me to the new commissioner of culture, Curtis Sliwa, and Sliwa said, you know, with any luck, Mort, he said, you know, we can pressure Cuomo with the Stern candidacy into, coming out for capital punishment.
Uh-huh.
And the mayor said to me, when can we look forward to some executions? We talked about that. You know, we got a Republican in L.A., too.
Who's that?
Mayor Reardon.
Okay.
Yeah, liberals, you know, can elect any Republican. They drive people crazy. They drive people crazy, and people always go the other way. It's always that way. It's national, too. You know what we mean when we say a liberal, Stuart?
No, what
anyone,
is a liberal?
Well, anyone who's in favor of busing and against prayer, and a conservative is in favor of prayer and against busing, and a moderate would like to see a compromise with prayer on the bus, on the way, right? Isn't that? Compromise is the big word with moderates. Everybody's a liberal till it costs them a quarter. That's what I've always found.
Yeah. Mort, how would you classify yourself politically?
Leaning to the left to correct for drift would be my, it's kind of relevant. I'm against them all. That's my job. And the last guy I liked was Roosevelt.
Franklin, I assume, not
you
Teddy.
You know, this hotel, you know, I remember when Jimmy Carter was here. I was working on the Today Show for NBC, the convention. And I remember this was a new hotel then, and they had all the floors were named after different states.
Uh-huh.
Anxiety and depression. All right, anyway, so the lithium farm in North Litchfield, Connecticut. Anyway, so Jimmy Carter, I was downstairs, and he was going to the convention. He was the heir apparent. And I was downstairs with Ed Bradley, of course, the 60 Minutes. He was then a fourth-string reporter for CBS, and he said to me, I don't know what I'm going to do to get some attention. Everybody, you know, Cronkite's got a lock and everything. So here comes Lillian Carter out of the building. And she walked out, and Ed said to her, do you identify with Rose Kennedy now because your son is going to be the candidate and you feel jeopardy and all? And she said, oh my God, no, Jimmy would never do anything they'd shoot him for. Just kind of a promise that was fulfilled.
Nice.
Felt. Isn't that interesting? And he stayed up there, and I watched the room service outside his suite. It was American cheese on white bread and milk. He had that for a week.
Well, I remember vividly. I covered that convention here.
Oh, okay.
And I remembered vividly, especially about room service. Carter's press secretary was Hamilton Jordan from
Jody Powell, and Ham was the strategist.
Right.
Yeah.
Was Jody Powell.
Yeah, then. Right.
And I remember Jody ordering orange juice and coffee from room service here, and he was aghast when he got the check. He said, orange juice and coffee in New York, $17?
Yeah. Yeah, I bet.
Well, I guess you had to be there. We will talk.
With a sense of frugality they never practiced again. You may have. Jordan's a good guy, by the way. I met him on the Perot campaign.
Okay.
Terrific guy.
Mort, I want to go back and bring up such subjects as Richard Nixon, Alexander
sure.
Haig,
fine.
Dwight Eisenhower, the McCarthy anyway. Era, and other stuff after this.
Hey, listen, my whole life is a cabaret. I've seen them all, but I've never seen anything like Rainbow and Stars.
She sells out London's Café Royale. She stands out in Robert Altman's new film, Shortcuts. And now she sings out. Annie Ross makes her debut performance at Rainbow and Stars atop Rockefeller Center. Come up to the 65th floor and sit this close to a singer with the most intimate style in cabaret. They say once Annie sings a song, it's hers, and you'll hear why. Annie, how does it feel to be back in the Big Apple?
Well, I'm always keyed up when I get to New York, and this time I'm up at Rainbow and Stars. I mean, look at the view. Look at the audience. Just come up and let's get together for a real good time.
She's talking and singing to you. Annie Ross, the boss at Rainbow and Stars atop Rockefeller Center. Call 632-5000.
This is the Broadway Hour on AM 93 WPAT. I'm Stuart Klein, and with me is Mort Saul. Mort, you emerged on the national scene in the early Eisenhower years, firing barbs at Ike and Company.
Yeah.
When you look back mm-hmm. on the Eisenhower era, does it look better now than it did back then?
It does to the Republicans. They honor him now, you know. they keep talking about how wonderful he was. You know, I remember the headline on the Boston Globe when Kennedy was elected, you know, it said, Boston millionaire forecloses on old soldier's home, you know, but anyway.
It really said that.
I thought Eisenhower was reasonably provincial, like all those people that are work for the government all their lives and then keep talking about socialism. What a threat it is. But, you know, they're all very vulnerable. The thing is, the liberals are very defensive now with Clinton, especially the women, you know, about how wonderful she is. And they'll keep that up, you know, until Hillary Clinton resigns. You know, they're a terrible constituency, the liberals. If they're your friends, you better get a daytime job, because when there's blood in the water, they'll jump ship, you know. Look at Woody Allen, who's not political, but his constituency are the people now who boycott the movies. They found him guilty, you know. You know, if you aren't suffering in your marriage, they don't like you. That's a liberal stipulation. You know,
Mort Hall redefines liberalism.
No, the liberals redefined it.
Mort, in that same Eisenhower era, of course, was the McCarthy years and other stuff, which was not very nice to look back on.
Hardly.
Did you ever take any heat for some of the stuff you leveled about McCarthy? Or
not much. I think that conservatives are very secure. You know, they think you're just a flea in an elephant's back. I mean, and they're probably right, more right than wrong. Conservatives are not guilty about anything they've stolen over the years. Liberals are guilty. You know, I don't deserve it. I tend to agree with them, by the way. You got to remember, see, the conservatives are as bad as they were when they started. But the liberals have picked up the baggage of the blacklist of the writers, not doing anything about Vietnam, not doing anything about the Kennedy assassination, not doing anything about the CIA. Just kind of, you know, watching their stock investments. And that guilt is what paralyzes them. It's the guilt, you know? They've got all that baggage, is what I'm saying. And they've tried to discharge it. Look at what happened. All those people I knew, I went to school with in Berkeley, who were all communists, then went into Dianetics, which became Scientology. And now they're all into nutrition. And, you know, and look at the way they've capitulated in the popular arts. Look at the music. They go into the Gap, and that stuff is pounding at you, and they don't say anything. They don't protest. John Updike said, if you're 60 years old, you grew up afraid of your parents, and now you're afraid of your children.
Mort, will there ever be material as rich on the public face than it was back during the Nixon years?
Oh, yes, there is all the time. I mean, look at Clinton. You can take anything. You can take Whitewater, or you can take David Gergen is a good example. His number one confidant is a guy who worked for Nixon and for Reagan. You know the apocryphal story, Stuart, about how Gergen came to Clinton's attention. Yeltsin walks into the Oval Office there. Remember when they had the photo opportunity? And they make small talk while they take pictures, because, of course, there's no soundtrack and no audio track. So Yeltsin says to him, how's it going? And Clinton says, not great. The Congress is really a pain. You know, they're going to investigate me and all. So Yeltsin says, well, I've got a tip. Why don't you do what I do? Send tanks down and fire on the Congress. And Clinton knows the press is listening. So to make a good impression, he says, President Yeltsin, that's not the way we do things in this country. And Gergen kicks President Clinton under the table and says, keep quiet and listen to him. He's trying to help us. Okay, so there. So, you know, it's anything you want.
Mort, how do you view the fact that Richard M. Nixon,
yeah,
who resigned in disgrace from the presidency, the only person in history to
so
ever
far.
Do that, has
yes,
now sort of reemerged as an older statesman?
Two reasons. One is he's smart. He's brilliant on foreign affairs. And the second is he is not a whiner. He never indulged in self-pity. If you look back, check me out. I'm right about that. He doesn't indulge in it. He says, if you continue to hate your enemies, they own you, which is what any good analyst will tell you after you get divorced. By the way, have you ever heard of a man who went into analysis to save his marriage that didn't wind up divorced? The doctor will never put you back together with a woman. It's one of their sacred oaths. So, but, you know, Nixon, I'll tell you a great joke Nixon told me.
All right.
This is, a Russian goes to the market and he finds bread. He can't believe it. He gets bread and a banana. It's old, but he can't believe it. And he goes home. He says, I don't suppose the water's working. And the water's not only on, but it's hot. Just, wow. And I'll try the TV and it's working. Instead of enjoying the bread, the banana, the TV and the water, he panics and he runs next door and he knocks on his neighbor's door and he says, Ivan, run for your life. The communists are back. Richard Nixon.
He did have a sense of humor.
I'll tell you what else. He enjoys the subtler stuff. He repeats a joke of mine where a movie star who's a liberal has children that are both Republicans. He says, why would that be? And I say to him, maybe because of all the recreational drugs you took in the 60s, your children are mutants. He repeats that joke all the time, so he's pretty hip. I'd say he's pretty hip.
In retrospect, how do you look back on the Kennedy administration?
Well, I think that was the last optimism in America. I think that the unraveling comes after Jack Kennedy, who, by the way, had a pretty good sense of humor himself, you know. I mean, really brilliantly funny. I wonder how many of you remember being the first Catholic who ran for high office when the head of the Houston Baptist Conference said, are you going to take your orders from the Pope when you're elected? And he said, the hereafter doesn't bother me, but November 4th is driving me out of my mind. He was really, you know, or when May Craig from the Maine paper said to him, what are you doing for women? And he said, fine, thank you. He was great. By the way, no sense of humor in any of the political leaders now. Have you noticed that?
There is a lack of. As a matter of fact,
it's great.
Two senators who I find personally despicable in their politics are probably the funniest guys on Capitol Hill.
Who?
Simpson from Wyoming.
Yeah, and, great sense of humor.
And Dole from Kansas.
That's true. Uh-huh. Dole said, his wife, Lydia, is president of the American Red Cross. He said, when I fall asleep, I don't know if I'll be missing any blood in the morning or not.
How do you view the remaining Teddy Kennedy?
Well, he's a revelation of what the liberals have become. He stood up for women. It's a great speech after the Anita Hill hearing in the Congressional Record. He stood up for black people. He stood up for Chicanos. He stood up on the child labor laws. And the liberals will never nominate him. All they do is ridicule him on the stage, of course. My job is to kid him, too. So I tell a true story in which I was in Los Angeles at the Streisand's house when Clinton came. And she says to me, I know that you love Jack Kennedy, so I want to tell you, Clinton's like Jack Kennedy. And Goldie Hawn was there, and she says to me, Mort, Clinton is a lot like Jack Kennedy. And in fact, I think Gore is like Jack Kennedy. And the whole evening, everybody kept talking about Jack Kennedy. So I turned to Lou Wasserman, and I said to him, is there anybody in the Democratic Party that isn't like Jack Kennedy? He said, yeah, Ted Kennedy. That's a rhythm joke.
Mort, it's your job to throw barbs at American society. How do you view American society in toto? Where are we going? How do we look?
We're drifting. People are pessimistic. They're supposed to get their dreams from the writers and from the lyrics of music. That's what you aspire to. And the people that are writing that stuff aren't dreaming anymore. When you hear the bridge of Speak Low, time is so old and love so brief, love is pure gold and time a thief. We don't have that anymore now. I would say, not to be ponderous, but still, I must say to you that the dreaming stopped after Vietnam. The people were shattered. That's why the music, young people's music, is extremely barbaric and a lot of whining and complaining about their parents letting them down rather than going forward and making a world of their own. I think people feel powerless. That's why they call talk radio.
Yeah. Do you find this blandness, this lack of artistry in music, a general rule in the arts as a whole?
Yeah, well, it's in the movies, too. The movies are very explicit sexually, you know. I see more than I care to in every movie. And sex has become so permissive. It's become something impersonal so that you won't ask anything personal. It'll keep you occupied. And then everybody, young people, wonder why it's not so great. I can tell you.
Why sex is not so great?
Yes, because you're waking up with strangers. It wasn't meant to be. You're not supposed to be with a stranger. When it happens, it's supposed to be a kind of a fulfillment. So that all comes from movies, and the violence in movies, of course, is pandering. You know, those movies are all written by guys from film school who never had a fight on the way home from school. I know about that. You know, I've written 18 movies myself. Good and I can tell you what that is. I worked on hundreds of pictures you've seen. I worked at Rewrite Man on The Firm, and I worked on Ordinary People, and I worked on a picture called Regarding Henry, which is about lawyers. You remember that started the cycle? And I'm standing there in a set, and I said to Mike Nichols, the director, I said, you know, this guy's a jerk. This lawyer, he's a rat.
Uh-huh.
And then he gets shot. Remember in a store buying cigarettes?
Right.
And after he's shot in the head, he becomes a wonderful guy. I said, the picture is really saying that every lawyer should be shot because it's beneficial. But he has no sense of humor about those things, I found.
Mort, can you give us something uplifting, something of hope and promise for our
yes.
life today? Lay
yes.
it on us.
Yes, remember that the problems are tough, but we're tough, and we have a unique set of weapons to fight negation. We were born as Americans, and if you don't believe me, go back and look at a movie with Steve McQueen or Lee Marvin. Go back and look at a movie which is on TNT tonight called Marooned, in which Gregory Peck, as the head of manned space at the Cape, says, the trip to the moon was a walk around the block. We're going to stars. We're Americans.
Getting very deep here with Mort Saul. And of course, I think the primary weapon that Americans have is humor. And no one has it more than Mr. Mort Saul.
Well, thank you for taking me seriously, Stuart.
Well, I'm the one. Ladies and gentlemen, Mort Saul, whose show opens tonight at Theater 4 on West 55th Street. Mort, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks, I had a great time.
We'll be back with Dorothy Loudon after this. This month, go see Annie Ross at Rainbow and Stars. That's a commercial, but I'm saying it from the heart, too. Annie Ross at Rainbow and Stars. Our next guest won the Tony Award for her performance as Miss Hannigan in Annie, and she's sparkled in a galaxy of Broadway turns. She's featured in the tribute to lyricist Carolyn Lee in the show opening Sunday night at the 92nd Street Y. Ladies and gentlemen, her personal favorite, Miss Dorothy Loudon.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you, Stuart. Well, I was having a good time. I hate to have it come to an end. I love Annie and I love Mort. It takes me back, so I can't bear it. The years are just rolling back.
Sort of.
We all were around at the same time, and it's kind of nice we're all still here. Amazing, actually.
Dorothy, when did you start in the business?
Where? Somewhere around the Boer War.
Where are you from?
I'm from Boston.
And how did you begin in show business?
I think somebody asked me once what my big motivation was, and it was just to get out of my hometown. It wasn't Boston then. It was a tiny town in New Hampshire. And I just came here. I just wanted so badly to be in the theater.
You came to New York
cold? I went to Syracuse. And
study theater?
Nothing was happening. And there was a guy there whom I admired very much, Sawyer Falk. And he said, you know, if I were you, those were the days, it was so long ago, you had to wait for your junior year to major. Uh-huh. So I was taking things like zoology, and, you know, it was pretty grim, and lying about Jim.
What was your first theater job in New York?
In New York, my first theater job was an evening of Jules Feiffer, and it was in Huntington Hills, New Jersey. We were trying to figure out if we had enough to bring it to New York. It was Mike Nichols' first show, first directing job. Stephen Sondheim wrote his first theater song. It was incredible. It never came into town.
Your very first show you worked with Mike Nichols and Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And then I did...
But I think even though that show didn't come to New York, you made a name for yourself in it, no?
Oh, God, not that I remember.
No?
No.
Okay.
I hope so. Well, in Huntington Hills, New Jersey, you know.
Well, you were noticed, I think.
Well, no, I was noticed by Mike and Stephen, and we remained friends over the years, but not really. It was kind of a sad experience.
And then what happened after?
Well, I did, the first thing I did was the National Company of Love, the Murray Siskel play.
Uh-huh.
But I did clubs. I worked in clubs when I first came here. I worked in clubs for 15, 17 years I got in the theater. I was an old woman by the time I got in the theater, comparatively.
You were right at home when the ice machine went off during Annie's
song. Honey, it just brought my hair, my palms started to sweat. You know, it's just, it never changes.
Did you work at any of those joints with guys with broken noses?
Oh, I mean, I worked at a place called the Crystal Lounge in Troy, New York. It was Frank Vaccarelli's Crystal Lounge. And I was on top of this whirling bar. I used to play piano and sing when I first started. And, you know, you look down at the key, you're making contact with the guys and the girls at the bar, and you look down at the keys and you look up and they're gone and you're looking at somebody else. And it was all mafia. And I didn't know what that was. I thought it was kind of exciting. Actually, it was. But it was in Troy, New York. And I think Troy, I remember I was with MCA then, and some guy up there said, "You'll love it. It's a big shoe town." I never really knew. But, you know, I worked Mr. Kelly's, where Moore at work, big star, there he was. Blue Angel, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And Annie worked down at the Bonsoir. We all worked around the same time.
I guess after you work places like that, you can work anywhere.
You can do anything. Uh-huh. You can do anything.
Dorothy, what was the first big break in the theater for you?
Well, I did a lot of things, excuse me, that I loved doing. I've been very lucky. I played great parts. The shows didn't necessarily run. They didn't run. They closed is what they did. But I'm very well known. I'm on the walls at Joe Allen's. I've closed in more shows than anybody in town.
For those who do not know, Joe Allen's is a restaurant with a lot of placards on the wall.
Shows that didn't last longer than a week. Yeah. I'm very big up on the wall. But I suppose you'd have to say the biggest break in the theater was Annie. Because it opened up all kinds of worlds for me. It was a great thing, and it was I kind of came in out of the cold. It was wonderful.
What about that old adage, Dorothy, about you should never work with kids? Apparently that didn't apply with you.
No, but tenors, that's true. And dogs. But no, I had a good time. I had a great time. It was the first time I was ever in a hit. I it was difficult to get used to.
And what a hit. How long did you do that?
Well, I was in it just 10 months because my husband died. And I associated so much of that with Norman that I left. I went right into Michael Bennett's ballroom. I was rehearsing
that. I loved that show.
And I did too. You were one of the few that did.
And it never got anywhere.
No, it really, I don't think anything that he did after A Chorus Line.
Well, that was his first show after A Chorus Line. And I think everyone laid too much of pressure on him.
I don't think it would have mattered what he did. I think they wanted him to top it, and you couldn't really, you know, and he tried.
Dorothy, you did one thing that just killed me. I mean, I cried.
What?
That was at the tribute to Sondheim at Carnegie Hall. Oh. And you sang a song. What was the number?
I did. It was a thing, two things put together. It was out of my mind. Losing my mind.
Losing my
mind. You could drive a person crazy. Yeah. And the two songs put together.
And they were a remarkable combination, because Losing My Mind goes straight to the heart.
Oh, it's tremendous.
And Drive a Person Crazy is absolute slapstick.
Really terrified. I never knew till the actual performance if that was going to work. And somehow, Carnegie Hall became like an intimate cabaret. I couldn't believe it. And they were with me, and they were laughing in the right places, and it was one of those unique times when you knew, and I never experienced this, you knew that nothing was going to go wrong. You know,
that was a great, great night.
It was
theater.
A wonderful night, yeah.
Dorothy, you've been in a zillion shows. What's the funniest thing that's ever happened to you on stage?
Well, the funniest show I've ever done was Noises Off. That was... There'll never be a funnier.
Your British
show.
Comedy.
Yeah. I don't ever remember.
I mean, do you ever scenery ever fall down? People blow up, lose their lines, anything?
Not
wild?
Really.
Wild. Okay.
No, I've had a pretty dull. you know, I just show up, and no, things just keep closing on me. But
well, you're as far as I know, the tribute to Carolyn Lee at the Y Sunday night is still in existence.
That's going to be wonderful.
Tell us about
that. It's April 10th and 11th. This Lyrics and Lyricists series is going into its 25th year next year. Mm-hmm. And it's Maurice Levine. He's put it all together. It's just a work of art. And it's become one of the staples of New York City. It's just a darling evening, and it's a tribute to lyricists. And as Mort said, lyricists are poets. And it's the optimism of the lyricists that used to be around in those days that kept absolutely. That's wonderful. He just said custodian of dreams.
What are you going to be singing there, Dorothy?
I'm doing it's all Carolyn Lee, so I'm doing naturally, Hey, Look Me Over. Uh-huh. I'm doing It Amazes Me, which is a divine song. I'm doing a song she sent to me when I was working at the Blue Angel, when she, like many, many other people, like Sheldon Harnick and Freddie Ebb and people like that, used to write material for people like me.
Mm.
And I always wrote my own material. And I didn't do material per se, because I was never very funny. I just did songs and they all fell apart. So that was pretty funny. But she sent me a song. I had never met her. And it was a wonderful song called Westport. And it's never been done. And it's kind of, well, it's a song about this game they play in Westport. I can't tell you about it. Cause
I can imagine.
It's better than musical chairs, but what isn't?
Dorothy, if there is one show or one role you've always wanted to do and have never done, what would it be?
Oh, my. Anything that Tennessee Williams wrote.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. That's poetry. Musically, I'd love to do Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Mm.
I'd love to do that. I'd love to do Bells Are Ringing. I'd love to do anything that... I'd love to do Gypsy, but there isn't a woman alive that sings that wouldn't love to do Gypsy, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that the definitive Gypsy has been done by that very young girl, Bette Midler. And she was marvelous. But she was right for the... I mean, she was the right age, too. You know, I think I'm too old now. I'm doing Driving Miss Daisy all over the country, and I... I can't imagine that with music, can you?
Driving Miss Daisy is a musical? I don't
musical.
Think so.
No, but I'll do anything that I like. I mean, I just love to work.
Well, I truly love seeing you.
Well, you've been wonderful to me
and
all
I
over
hope,
the years.
I truly hope, Dorothy, that you find some Broadway project.
Oh,
we
honey.
Need people like you.
Thank you very much.
States.
Well, I'm here. I'm not going anywhere.
Ladies and gentlemen, for Dorothy Loudon, call the Broadway Hour. Producers, please take note.
Thank you.
Dorothy, I'm looking forward to coming over to the Y and seeing.
Please do.
I
think
love
you'll like,
Carolyn
you love
Lee's
Carolyn
stuff.
Lee. I know you did. I did, too.
She used to be in a poker game I was in.
Who played in that poker game?
Well, Julie Stein, the composer. Hal Haggerty, lyricist, and Bernie the jeweler. And it was not a game for the faint of heart. It still goes on.
Fabulous.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to catch a wonderful performer, and you're going to be with some great people, who else is in that Y tribute?
Sure. Claiborne Carey, Billy Stritch, Christine Baranski is a fine actress and a singer. She's going to be the MC. Sarah Zahn. Jeff Harner. I know I'm leaving someone
Sounds
out.
Good.
Oh, myself. I left myself out.
A tribute to Carolyn Lee at the 92nd Street Y, Sunday and Monday nights, starring a bunch of great people, including Miss Dorothy Loudon.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Great seeing you. And we'll be back after this. This is the Broadway Hour on AM 93 WPAT. I'm Stuart Klein. And here's the Broadway update, brought to you by Taittinger Champagne, the official champagne of the Broadway Hour. This week's Broadway openings range from Euripides to A Tumbler. The Greek tragedy, Medea, starring Diana Rigg, opens Thursday at the Longacre. The Tumbler, the word comes from the ancient Greek getumel, meaning to make a racket, is Jackie Mason, whose new one-man show, Politically Incorrect, opens tomorrow at the Golden Theater. And as noted, another veteran comic, Mart Saul, opens with his new one-man stand-up show tonight at Theater 4. Ron Silver will not be in the Broadway cast of Broken Glass, Arthur Miller's new play. Silver, without comment, left the drama, scheduled to open at the Booth April 24th. The play was panned severely by Variety when it opened 2 weeks ago in New Haven. This Broadway season, for the first time in Broadway history, has had more musical revivals than new musicals. And two more old musicals may be headed here if their productions make a splash on the road. Kiss Me, Kate starts performances tomorrow at the Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut, and starting an 8-week run tomorrow at the Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey is Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific. The Royal Shakespeare Company's acclaimed London production of A Winter's Tale will come to the Brooklyn Academy of Music for a week starting April 19th. And before they get here, a plea to the Brooklyn Academy. Please, please do something about your lousy acoustics. As things stand there now, it's truly hopeless to see a play at the Academy when just about one out of every three words cannot be heard. And as I speak, that's the ice machine again behind me. At the superb Promenade Theater at 76th and Broadway, Edward Albee's acclaimed new play, Three Tall Women, starts an open-ended run tomorrow. Who Will Carry the Word, a play by Charlotte Dembo about 23 French women in Nazi concentration camps, resumes performances tomorrow at the Judith Anderson Theater. And here's a project that looks promising. The great clown Bill Irwin is the star and co-author of a new show called The Seattle Experiments, comprised of five short one-act plays. The other authors include David Ives, who wrote the hilarious off-Broadway hit All in the Timing, and comic actor Steve Martin. He's written a play. The show premieres in Seattle, April 22nd. Finally, it must have been a slow week for Theater Week columnist Peter Felicia. Musing in his column, he suggested that John and Lorena Bobbitt star in a production of I Do, I Do, because Lorena then would sing from the number Together Forever these lyrics, quote, "You can throw away your every care and doubt, because that's what married life is all about." That's the latest on the theater arts. Back with our trivia contest after this. It's trivia time, and the winner of this week's contest will win two tickets to see Annie Ross at Rainbow and Stars and Dinner for Two at Streeter's here at the Sheraton. Here's the question. The title character of a famous Broadway musical sings this advice as she walks out on her beau, quote, "On cold winter nights, you can hug your cash register. It's lumpy, but it still rings." David Rothenberg, what is the musical? Where's that show from, that song? He doesn't know, but if you want to take a shot at the freebie theater tickets and dinners, send your answer to The Broadway Hour, WPAT. Get your mail in early. We'll announce the winner on next week's show. Last week's question was, in a Tony Award-winning musical, a show-stopping number included these exquisite lyrics, quote, "Your pedal extremities are colossal. To me, you look just like a fossil." Annie Ross, you know that?
Nope.
Mort Saul? No. David Rothenberg? Well, Ernestine Miller of New York City knew the answer. The show is Fats Waller's Ain't Misbehavin', and the song is the immortal Your Feet's Too Big. Right, Annie. Congratulations, Ernestine. You win two tickets to Mort Saul's America and Dinner for Two at Streeter's here at the Sheraton. And now, ladies and gentlemen, from the original cast of Ain't Misbehavin', here's Ken Page and Your Feet's Too Big.
Running around in here. Yeah. Up in Harlem at a table for two. Well, there were the four of us, baby. Me, your big feet, and you. From your ankles up, I say you sure are sweet. But from there down, baby, you're just too much feet. Oh, your feet's too big. Don't want you, cause your feet's too mad at you, cause your feet's too big. I really hate you, cause your feet's too big. Yeah. Na, 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 na. eyes. She says you got what it takes to take her to paradise. Well, she likes your face, says she loves your ring. But look at him. Look at him. Your feet's too big. Oh, your feet's too big. Like a fossil, you got me walking, talking, and squawking. Cause your feet too big.
Ken Page and Your Feet's Too Big from Ain't Misbehavin'. Up in Harlem at a table for two, there were four of us, me, your big feet, and you. Annie Ross, they don't write them like that anymore, huh?
Right, they sure do.
Annie, the last time I saw you before your appearance here at Rainbow and Stars was in the superb Robert Altman film Shortcuts. And you played a role that was not No-No Nanette. You had a
you could say that.
Somber role. That was a wonderful picture. Altman was nominated for Best Director, but the movie, I think, was too sardonic, too heavy to gain popular appeal.
Well, it wasn't riding off into the sunset, not by any means.
How was it working with Altman, making that
movie? It was incredible. Bob is wonderful. I mean, he's very calm, he's very collected. He knows exactly what he wants. It's like, it was like being in a large family and having him at the head of the table.
How did you view the movie, Annie?
How did I view it?
Yeah.
I thought it was absolutely true to life.
Annie Ross, we're running out of time, unfortunately. Last word about your current gig back in the Big Apple.
Well, come and have a good time.
I will. I'm going to see you Saturday night.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ms. Annie Ross. And you've been listening to the Broadway Hour. Thanks to our guests, Annie Ross, Mort Saul, and Dorothy Loudon. We're on the Broadway Hour on AM 93 WPAT every Monday night from 6 to 7. Tune in next week when our guests will include the great Barbara Cook and Oscar-winning actor F. Murray Abraham, now starring as Roy Cohn in Angels in America. Thanks to our producer, what's your name? Kate McGrath. Our engineer, Chris Breitfeld. And all the folks at WPAT. This is the Broadway Hour. I am Stuart Klein. Thank you, and break a leg.